Now, the reason why I'm telling you all this about hunting is because it can be seen that with a more geographically permanent and settled type of existence based on food production, and with the consequent creation of surpluses, which of course could be fought over, organized warfare and the development of slavery based upon war prisoners, the position was that the men in primitive society were already in a social position, as it were, well versed in the use of weapons, etc., to take on the role of fighting. And of course, they were also the immediate owners of the spoils of war. And it was this, I would contend, and factors like this, which gave rise to a position of domination by the men over the women. And this position was further consolidated with the rise of the state, which at first was a military slave state based upon farming, and in the case of Egypt, the highest personage of the state, the pharaoh, was both king and god combined. So that when you're dealing with hunter-gatherer groups, they had a nomadic way of life. The size of the community was small, very, very low population density. It meant that band society was a very, very simple society. It lacked the integrative devices of higher levels of society, such as the Neolithic and also of modern capitalism. Now, I won't go into anything further. I could go into in greater detail with the kind of lifestyle that food and hunting culture personified, but I would like to point this out, that in primitive food gathering and hunting society, monogamy is the general form of marriage. And of course, all these arguments about incest and exogamy is a kind of rule about marriage, not just sexual behavior. The incest taboo, which we have a lot of argument about, has to do with sexual behavior, not marriage. Our own tendency to connect marriage with sex, as we do in our ideals at least, is a very peculiar association that grew up in our very unusual society, namely capitalism. In primitive society particularly, and in most societies generally, marriage is undertaken for a great many reasons, but love is irrelevant, and sexual rights are almost incidental to it. In fact, in many societies, the married couple might have never met. In others, they may have been betrothed before they were born, that is, promised by the parents. Now, the question arises, why do people in primitive societies marry? Well, for one thing, people seem to want to establish themselves as adults. That's one reason why they like to get married. And there is no way to do this except by marriage. On the other hand, the economic division of labor in hunter-gathering societies is such that unless adult males and females share the work as husband and wife, each would remain a dependent, an appendage, as it were, of another family. Ordinarily, that would be of their parents. So marriage is an economic necessity. Nothing to do with sex. Sex, however, as much as that may be a necessity, is easily satisfied in primitive society without marriage. So the fact is that there may be, of course, other adult requirements that marriage does satisfy. Probably most people want children. Others want to get away from their own parents or brothers, and so on. But all of these are only reasons why various individuals might find the institution of marriage welcome, not why the institution exists in the first place, nor that its role is for society as a whole. In primitive society, a certain kind of marriage rule results in a certain kind of system of relationship. Marriage is an economic institution from the point of view of the partners. But for the parents of the couple, and especially for the band as a whole, marriage has very important political functions. And I use the word political not in the sense that it's used today, but in the sense of the body politic in relation to the community, as it were. That kind of a connotation. The variations in the marriage rule have various political results, particularly with respect to the alliances created among bands, and they can be narrow and firm or extended and loose. In other words, exogamy is practiced, that is, people don't marry in their own group. They marry outside of the group. And, of course, there's all these relationships that are necessary. As I said earlier, hunter-gatherer peoples tend to have monogamic marriage, although there's nothing hard and fast about this. In relation to the status of women, there were two opposing factors. One, the fear inspired by women's particular biological functions, for example, menstruation periods, etc., which tended to inspire a belief in witchcraft, like magic, possessed by women, so that hunters going forth on a big band hunt had by custom to refrain from having anything to do with their wives. The done thing to do was to refrain from having sexual intercourse. And this, of course, would be based upon a real necessity. For example, I remember reading one anthropologist who was discussing whether polygamy was degrading to women. And he was trying to apologize, as it were, for polygamy. And he says, well, it's not always a degrading proposition. And he instanced one man who went to a local missionary and asked for a powerful aphrodisiac to enable him to visit his 11 wives, all of them on the same night, every night. Now, I would imagine that that kind of operation would be instrumental in rendering him absolutely incompetent as a hunter in the days to follow. So that is something which has arisen as a result of a real economic necessity. So that it was regarded as having an adverse effect on the hunt, and this developed into a kind of magical belief in the existence of a particular kind of witchcraft which women had as women. The attitudes connected with childbearing and fertility, this was an opposing attitude, recognizing that woman was the giver of life. This idea was carried into the realm of agriculture, and women, as the givers of life and fertility, were elevated into the position, idealistically that is, as goddess, with the development of food production in Neolithic times. One should or ought to get the impression that the status of women would have become greater and more elevated. The fact that it did not, I would contend, can only be explained by the development of private property relations in the way in which it has been suggested earlier on. Now, I'm not going into a lot of detail about this domination of women, because this should be the subject of a talk particularly on this development, including the modern woman's lib manifestations and development. But I would like to emphasize that, in my view, there is no evidence to suggest that women were regarded on a sexual basis as inferior to men. It's not the case in existing hunter-gatherer peoples. I would say that the main factor for the domination of women by patriarchal society and the instances of matriarchal society are only a few in number. There have been cases of matriarchal society, but it's not a general proposition. It varies. But I would emphasize that the reason for women's inferiority through the ages, over a period ever since civilization came into operation, was determined by private property relationships. Right.
You're talking about some primitive form of grain, where they could, yes, I think, enough grain in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Lasting a year.
A year. Yes.
Was there any indication of how that grain was stored, or did they find ways of feeding it to animals or were storing by them?
Well, generally, although I didn't deal with this because it would have taken up far too much time, and I'll mention this when I deal with Man the Toolmaker, it was generally kept in storage pits, which were dug into the ground and then covered over. That was the general way of storing the grain. And, of course, there were the use of stone vessels, particularly before the invention and development of pottery. They found ways of polishing stone. And if you've been, for example, into the Natural History Museum or to the museum in Oxford, the Pitt Rivers Museum, there are some wonderful examples of stoneworking, both of Paleolithic times and Neolithic stoneworkings, and also Paleolithic tools that have been made by modern Stone Age people, as it were, Australians, you know, the Aborigines, out of bottle glass. And the examples of arrowheads that have been made by these people from bottle glass are really amazing. And that's only with the ordinary stone chipping process. Of course, with the Neolithic, the stone was first of all chipped off, would go through the Paleolithic process, as it were, and then it was polished by sarsen stone, largely. And it was polished to a very, very fine finish. The same thing would occur with the stone jars that they made from stone. You know, they were constructed in much the same way. They were chipped out, they were chipped away, and they were polished. Very, very slow process, but there were actual factories producing stone implements. There have been sites discovered, several sites in Europe, particularly in Britain. I forgot perhaps to show you what the distribution, seeing that you've mentioned wheat and barley. There's a map, if you of the distribution of wheat and barley and rice before 5000 BC, before 4000 BC, and so on. You see, it's called the Neolithic Revolution, And we always think of something being very, very quick. But in relation to the time that man has been on the earth, say 1 million years, and in relation to the succession of life during geological time, it's only a very, very short period, even although it's 8,000 years. And the development was very, very quick indeed. And the intensification, the speed up of the process became faster and faster, as it is now, of course. Technical development is now tremendously fast. So that 8,000 years is not a very long time. And out of 8,000 years, capitalism has been in operation, what, 400 years? What about the historical expert here? What would you say, 400 years or 500 years? No more than 500 years at the very outside. And yet the tremendous advances that capitalism has made outstrips all previous technical developments. But nevertheless, it's based upon essential discoveries. You see, you can't have technical advance of the kind that took place in the Industrial Revolution without laying the basis for that revolution as far as food production is concerned. Food production was a very, very essential march on for mankind, and it still remains a very, very crucial factor. As I mentioned earlier, Comrade Hardy mentioned the transition that was taking place in agriculture, the increase in productivity on the part of the people that actually were doing the farming. But nevertheless, farming is now done by people working in factories, producing tools, producing fertilizers, tractors, plows, and so on. So that it's a social... It isn't that, that the demarcation between agricultural workers and industrial workers really doesn't exist anymore, if it ever did at any time. You know, I mean, possibly there was a period when you had a specialization into farming and into craftsmanship and factory working, but certainly not in the Neolithic period. The Neolithic period was a period where there was a great combination of food production, domestication of animals, production of works of art, and so on. And, of course, the development of the so-called art of warfare. It was on the basis of slave production, developed very quickly, very early in Egypt, because you had in Egypt, you see, the periodic flooding of the Nile would bring about the periodic growing of wild cereals and the knowledge obtained by people living near its banks that this was what was taking place. And very soon you would get people that were purposely sowing the wheat at the right time. And of course, with the development of class society, you had a situation where people like Ramesses II could build or could get built vast pyramids like the one at Cheops, all upon slave labor, but nevertheless, as little as the slaves may have got as far as sustenance was concerned, yet it had to be produced. You had to produce a surplus to enable people to carry out quite futile and useless work to the glory of the Pharaoh God. So that alongside of this food production was also the development of warfare, because it was very, very advantageous to capture somebody else's food production and also to capture slaves alongside of it. That's why Egypt was always constantly at war with the Hittites and the various other groups, Syrians and so on, based upon the same kind of civilization. That was one of the reasons why you had organized warfare. Organized warfare was for the purpose largely of capturing slaves and pinching somebody else's production. If there was a famine, for example, if your crop had failed, then it was a good idea to attack somebody else and pinch theirs. So that this was what was occurring. Yes. There were various civilized groups that were contending for supremacy. The Hittites was one war which the pharaohs were engaged in. Ramesses III, for example, fought quite a long war with the Hittites, who were a group, I think, emanating from Mesopotamia. But the Egyptians...
What was the location of that battle?
Well, the location, as far as I can remember, the location of that battle was somewhere in the desert near to Sinai. I think that was the location. It's a long time since I read about it, but there were various battles. In the particular battle that I'm thinking of, and possibly you're thinking of, Ramesses III, who didn't build the pyramids like his predecessor, Ramesses II. He was more concerned. He was the warrior king, and he was able to defeat the Hittites and ensure a kind of tentative peace for a long time.
Yes, so the history states that the people of the Fertile Crescent, mainly in Palestine, were vassals to Egypt.
Yes.
Hittites, Moorites, Huskians, Jebusites, Amorites, Canaanites came up from, I think, Mesopotamia, Arabia, and settled into the Fertile Crescent, Palestine, maybe.
There was a period too when in the latter part of Ramesses II, where he encouraged a long period of peace, encouraged him to be a bit indolent and easygoing, as it were, for those times, and he allowed quite a lot of other peoples to settle peacefully, and of course with the warring groups. Made use of these, and they were intent upon, of course, defeating Egypt, but they were unsuccessful. But the Egyptians, of course, fought a number of wars. So did the Persians. I mean, there was a period when Egypt was at war with Persia.
But the Persian show was later than that.
Oh, it was later than that. Yes, much later. And so was the Greek. You know, the Ptolemies. And so on. That was.
Can I make a point for my hobby?
Yes, sure.
That Zionism and imperialism or anti-Zionism. We read about all this history, and I think Zionists would have us think that the children of Israel were there from the beginning of creation or the beginning of time, whichever way you look at it. In fact, all of us do told us about the children of Israel still could march out of the desert and still hadn't laid siege to the city states of Jericho and Jerusalem.
Quite right.
Yes. History,
sure. And how old the universal God is, really, because it was with the Israelites that the idea of an impersonal, unforeseen, universal God took root and was developed out of the kind of tribal God that they carried around in the box with them. In the wilderness, Jahweh, as it was called, Yahweh or Jahweh, I don't know how. Perhaps.
Yeah. Never say the name. So if you don't say the name, they will never know how it's said. It could be Yehovah or it could be
Yahweh. Yeah, right.
Don't
Well, okay, I don't mind being corrected by anybody, because as far as I'm concerned...
Nobody will ever know, because the Duke...
It's a secret, yes. It's a secret. It's like when you visit the pyramids, you have people sliding up to you, selling you containers of Egyptian darkness. And then when you opened them, the darkness disappeared, of course. Never there.
What I got to say, didn't the war evolve to some extent between tribes? It wasn't economics, but they just went out on the raid for raids of women at times.
Well, that is a proposition put forward by an anthropologist called McLennan, who was in opposition to Henry Lewis Morgan's contentions, and claimed that took place. I don't accept that at all. You see, the fact of the matter is that there's no need for primitive man to go out stealing women. You talked about tribal society. Well, tribal society is a stage further. You see, that's the trouble. A lot of people that are discussing, for example, women's lib, and also discuss what primitive man was like, they're not discussing primitive man at all. They're discussing tribal society, which is entirely different. For example, the Ituri pygmies, the Bar Mbuti, that live in central Ituri forest in the Congo, in the center of Africa, that have very little contact with the Bantu, that's the Negroes outside the area, they have no need to have any interference from anybody else, and they don't themselves interfere with anybody else. The point is that they are a self-contained community. And genetically, as I pointed this out earlier on in a talk that I gave, genetically, the birth of females and males is about equal. If you have, for example, polygamy on that basis, if it's not restricted artificially, like the Toda in the hills of India, who are a tribe that practice polygamy on the women's side, known as polyandry, they practice female infanticide. They kill off some of the women. Now that's an artificial imbalance, which is brought about by the intervention of society. But on a natural basis, there are as many females as there are males. That is the general average that arises out of ordinary, uninterrupted genetic composition and birth and so on. So that there is no position where, for example, in polygamous society on the man's side, where if you have an equal number of females and men, and some of the men collar, say, 11 and 12 and 14 women for their wives, it means that some of the men are left without a wife. It must mean that. And that is generally brought about by a particular kind of class society. Now, the people that in Paleolithic times could marry one woman, and they could be a economic unit, as I've described, but it's not necessarily a sexual proposition. I mean, there's more freedom in primitive society. Sex can be obtained with the consent of society. There's no barrier to a sexual life outside of marriage. You see, it's principally a recognition of an economic necessity, so that women have their place, but men also have their place. You know, it's not a question of of an inferiority, there is a natural equality that doesn't exist in either tribal society or society that has developed on modern lines, like capitalism, for example. Capitalism is monogamic up to a point. You see, it's monogamic as far as the legal position is concerned, but it doesn't prevent prostitution. Now, prostitution is completely unknown in food-gathering and hunting society, which hasn't come into contact with Western civilization. As soon as it does, then, of course, all the problems start. For example, some of the primitive peoples, the Andaman Islanders, for example, coming into contact with Europeans, were practically decimated, were practically rendered extinct by contracting diseases like measles, syphilis, whooping cough, and so on. And the same, of course, with the people that Darwin visited when he was voyaging in the Beagle, when they touched on Terra del Fuego, the Indians there were also decimated by unfamiliar diseases. So, to some extent, were the Tasmanians, although, of course, with the Tasmanians, it was a case of genocide. They simply carried out mass slaughter.
But that hasn't been perfect either.
And the same with the Red Indian tribes. The Red Indian tribes, and also in modern times in the Mato Grosso and other similar areas in America, in South America, the rancheros, the ranchers that want the land that is now occupied by primitive Indian tribes, purposely bring disease and have done, like smallpox and so on, to get rid of them. That's the kind of operation that Western civilization has carried out on these primitive peoples.
Yeah, but before that happened in fact, they've read in a little bit, because you can see the strain of some people in Hobart now.
Yeah, but
they're
among the Tasmanians and Aborigines, right?
They're finished.
Yeah, but they bred in before that happened.
Well,
Australians, well,
yes.
Well, the point is the certain tribes still in existence. The Arunta, for example, in Central Australia, is still in existence as a primitive tribe.
Now, but you see in Hobart, you still see the strain of some people getting around in Hobart.
Well, it hasn't been completely eliminated.
No, I'm
prepared to accept that. genetically speaking, for example, there are genes in existence that haven't mutated that have been in existence for millions of years. The same genes. Or genes, whichever the emphasis you put on the E. The fact of the matter is that as a group, the Tasmanians were wiped out.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the point I'm trying to make. And as far as the Indians at Terra del Fuego, they were also decimated in the same way.
Yeah, you're right what you said there, but they never made a perfect catastrophe.
Was there any opportunity for the Tasmanians to?
Well, it was a very, very remote possibility. It may have occurred, but the kind of attitude that was adopted in the case of Tasmania, I would say, militated very strongly against such an occurrence taking place. But, I mean, that doesn't preclude, of course, some of the Europeans taking advantage of some of the Tasmanian women, as very often occurred.
But their children would have died with them.
Pardon?
Their children would have died with them. And the child born on Tasmania to a Tasmanian
aboriginal woman. Yes.
Be proudly taken.
No, you're quite right. You're quite right. I'm inclined to believe that is the case. But I mean, I think you can also accept the unusual situation that perhaps it may have done in certain cases.
They like to dwell on the, you know, the greens, the plants. You were talking about the hybrids. And yet, you know, I'm not trying to score a point by any.
I don't mind if you do.
Have you mentioned, apart, you know, from the fact, you know, that you do recognise that there are hybrids in greens?
Yes.
And they, you know, there's a reproduction from these hybrids. Yet, you see, if you contrast it, you know, from your point of view, you seem to recognise, you see, the hybrids, you know, from the animal point of view, are mules, you see. I have heard you saying that, but this is not true, you see, that hybrids, you know, as far as animals, including our own species, human beings, are mule, you see. If you take the case, you see, of the buffalo and the cattle, you see, it's carrying on, this is a hybrid, and it's carrying on reproduction.
Yeah, well, in relation to what you're saying, I mentioned sterile hybrids. I didn't mention all hybrids. For example, the aurochs, which I mentioned, which was the foundation animal, as it were, of modern cattle. The last aurochs was killed in 1760 or something in Poland, the last living aurochs. But the aurochs has been bred back from existing cattle, which indicates that the species was not genetically isolated from the aurochs. In other words, the aurochs, genetically speaking, is the same as the modern cattle and vice versa. When you're talking about a mule and a horse, rather, you're talking about a donkey and a horse, it's a different proposition. You see, the fact of the matter is that donkeys and horses are genetically isolated. There is a different number of chromosomes. I don't remember exactly. I haven't got any data with me, but it's a different number of chromosomes in a horse to a donkey. So that if there was any mating that takes place, whilst offspring are possible, there is no germ cell that can be passed on. You see, if I gave you the machinery of inheritance, it depends, of course, upon the haploid and the diploid cell. And the diploid cell is the body cell. The haploid cell is the half cell, or the half group of chromosomes. In the case of human beings, it's 48 chromosomes. The germ cell is 24, which, if it's a spermatozoon, it links up with 24 of the ovum, the egg and the sperm, so that you have a recombination of 48 chromosomes. In the case of where there's an odd number, you can't have a complete division. Whilst you may get an offspring, that offspring can't hand on its gene structure, because there is no mechanism, or the mechanism is at fault, as it were. You've got an odd number, and consequently you can't recombine the cell, you see. So that there are times when what are apparently species are really only variations, because there's no hard and fast definition of a species. But it is recognized in modern times, among other things, that genetic isolation is one of the main definitions of a species. So that you, when you get a species that's isolated, it can't mate with another species. Now, in relation to wheat, you had, as I said, a trebling, a doubling, a trebling, and in fact a development into six different sets of chromosomes, which have been caused by this, you know, this conscious development on the part of mankind to pick certain attributes which were desirable. And it's brought about this differentiation in wheat. But of course, the wheat, it has to be maintained like that. It has to be maintained artificially like that.